Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
On this Monday, June 8th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your headlines. 2 weeks to the day after George Floyd died at the hands of a Minneapolis police officer, congressional Democrats outlining legislation in response to police brutality. News on the U.S. economy, which officially entered its first recession as the COVID-19 pandemic triggered the shutdown of businesses across the country. The National Bureau of Economic Research, the private research group responsible for making such determinations, made the designation today, declaring that the 128-month economic expansion, the longest on record, ended on February. But an update on Wall Street, we'll have the numbers later in the program. And new numbers out today in a CNN poll indicate the president's overall approval rating has dropped 7 points in a month. Overall, 38% approve the way he is handling his job, putting him on par with Jimmy Carter and George H.W. Bush at this point in their presidency. Both lost re-election. The story shaping Washington today, it's all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. We begin on Capitol Hill, where Democrats in both chambers introducing sweeping reforms with a single goal, to combat racial disparities in our country's criminal justice system. Today's announcement follows nearly 2 weeks of protests, marches, and demonstrations, including a massive march here in Washington, D.C. on Saturday. And at a news conference that began with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, members taking a moment of silence to represent the 8 minutes and 46 seconds that the Minneapolis police officer had his knee on the neck of George Floyd, leading to his death.
Before we have our moment of silence, which, as you indicated, is a very long time, especially with someone's knee on your neck. We gather in honor of those Americans and so many others. George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, Botham Jean, Terrence Crutcher, Jordan Davis, Oscar Grant, Philando Castile, Freddie Gray, Walter Scott, Tamir Rice, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Trayvon Martin. Any other names, members?
Judy Allen.
Sean Bell.
Jordan Davis.
Freddie Gray. Hello.
Alphon Taylor.
Anyone else?
Ahmaud Arbery.
We'll now, during the moment of silence, I'm sure that those who have been hurt by all of this won't mind if you shout out names then. For those who wish to, we will now kneel for our moment of silence.
And that went on for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. By the way, former Vice President Joe Biden in Houston today to pay his respects to George Floyd and his family, the final burial scheduled for tomorrow. According to TheHill.com, this legislation by congressional Democrats crafted by leaders of the Congressional Black Caucus, it's called the Justice in Policing Act, aims to rein in the use of excessive force by law enforcement officials, particularly the violence targeting blacks and other minorities who die disproportionately at the hands of police officers. The package, being viewed as the most aggressive crackdown on law enforcement to arrive in decades, would, among other things, establish a federal ban on chokeholds, eliminate the legal shield protecting police from lawsuits, mandate the use of body cameras nationwide, limit federal transfers of military-style weapons to local police, ban military style weapons for police officers, and create a national database disclosing the names of those officers with patterns of abuse. It also includes a bill passed by the House earlier this year that would make lynching a federal hate crime. California Democrat Karen Bass is the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus.
The Justice and Policing Act establishes a bold, transformative vision of policing in America. Never again should the world be subjected to witnessing what we saw on the streets in Minneapolis, the slow murder of an individual by a uniformed police officer. The world is witnessing the birth of a new movement in our country. This movement has now spread to many nations around the world, with thousands marching to register their horror at hearing the cry, "I can't breathe." People marching to demand not just change, but transformative change that ends police brutality, that ends racial profiling, and ends the practice of denying Americans the right to have the ability to sue when they have been injured by an officer, that denies local jurisdictions the power to fire or prosecute offending officers. Black communities have sadly been marching for over 100 years against police abuse, but for the police to protect and serve our communities like they do elsewhere. In the 1950s, news cameras exposed the brutal horror of legalized racism in the form of segregation. The news cameras of the 1950s exposed the brutal treatment of people who dared to challenge the system. News cameras exposed to the world that black people did not have the same constitutional protections, that freedom of speech, the right to assemble and protest were not rights extended to African Americans. 70 years later, it is the cell phone camera that has exposed the continuation of violence directed at African Americans by the police and exposed the reality that the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is not guaranteed to all African Americans at all times. Now the movement for police accountability has become a rainbow movement, reflecting the wonderful diversity of our nation and the world. The power of this movement will help move Congress to act, to pass legislation that not only holds police accountable and increases transparency, but assists police departments to change the culture. Now, I know that change is difficult, but I am certain that police officers, professionals who risk their lives every day, are deeply concerned about their profession and do not want to work in an environment that requires their silence when they know a fellow officer is abusing the public. I am certain police officers would like to be free to intervene and stop an officer from using deadly force when it is not necessary. And I am certain that police officers want to make sure they are trained in the best practices in policing. A profession where you have the power to kill should be a profession that requires highly trained officers who are accountable to the public.
That from Representative Karen Bass of California, the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. Democratic leaders framing the reforms as crucial and long overdue in dealing with racial injustices among law enforcement. More from today's news conference with Speaker Pelosi.
We cannot settle for anything less than transformative structural change, which is why the Justice in Policing Act will remove barriers to prosecuting police misconduct and covering damages by addressing the qualified immunity doctrine. It will demilitarize the police by limiting the transfer of military weaponry to state and local police departments. It will combat police brutality by requiring body and dashboard cameras, banning chokeholds, no-knock warrants in drug cases, and end racial profiling. We'll finally make lynching, Mr. Hoyer, a federal hate crime. And I salute Chairwoman Bass and Representative Bobby Smith and our two distinguished Senators Harrison Booker and others for their work in helping to pass H.R. 35 this year. Police brutality is heartbreaking reflection of an entrenched system of racial injustice in America. True justice can only be achieved with full comprehensive action. That's what we are doing today. This is a first step. There is more to come. In the coming weeks, the House will hold hearings, mark up the bill. Once the House passes it, the Justice and Policing Act, Leader McConnell will swiftly take it up. Leader in the Congress, the President must not stand in the way of justice. The Congress and the country will not relent until this legislation is made into law.
Speaker Pelosi, Congressional Democrats, the full news conference available on the web at cspan.org. Also today, nine members of the Minneapolis City Council announcing their support for defunding the Minneapolis Police Department and replacing it with a community-based public safety model. Now, with the support of those nine council members, they have created a veto-proof supermajority in City Council. However, to make any significant changes under the city charter, they would also likely need a public vote to change that charter. Meanwhile, former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin making his first court appearance today, where a judge set his bail at $1.25 million without conditions, or $1 million with conditions, including not working for law enforcement and no contact with George Floyd's family. The former Minneapolis police officer is facing second-degree and third-degree murder charges. On Twitter earlier today, the president writing the following, quote, "Law and order, not defund and abolish the police. The radical left Democrats have gone crazy," exclamation mark. And in a meeting earlier today with law enforcement officials at the White House, he had this to say.
So it's very interesting because I just see in some of the papers they want to end the police department. Quote, end the police department in Minneapolis. End it. What does that mean? End it. They had a couple of very rough nights, and they had a third night which was not good. They abandoned their police precinct, something I've never seen before. You had a mayor that asked them to abandon, and now they've abandoned the mayor, it looks like. The opposite of far thinking. You know, you say far thinking. Is that far thinking? So they had three really bad nights, and then I insisted on bringing in the National Guard, and all of a sudden it was like magic. It was in good shape. They helped with the police, but the police were told to leave their posts. Nobody's ever seen anything like that. But we insisted on having protection for that great city or that great state. A great state, Minnesota. What a horrible thing. That's where it started, and we ended very strong there once we got involved. We got involved right from the White House, and we weren't going to let that happen to that city or that state. And I think a lot of people took notice. The police are doing an incredible job. As I said, their records are being broken in terms of lack of crime, the lack of crime. We had a tremendous year, tremendous 12 months, a tremendous 36 months, I think you can say, during the term. Then you add 6 months to that. 3.5 years, it's gone by very quickly, but we've had a tremendous record on crime. And we're going to work and we're going to talk about ideas how we can do it better and how we can do it, if possible, in a much more gentle fashion. A thing like happened should never have happened. And plenty of things shouldn't have happened. But we can't give up the finest law enforcement anywhere in the world. There's nothing like it.
That from the White House earlier today with the president, and at the Daily Briefing, reaction to this Democratic plan and calls to defund police departments across the country. Caitlin Collins of CNN with this question to Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany.
Caitlin, two questions for you. As you are going over your reforms and what you think is needed, does the president feel that there is systemic racism in law enforcement?
The president's been very clear there are injustices in society. I've noted several for you that he's pointed out as a Republican primary candidate, noting the Sandra Bland video was absolutely horrible, noting George Floyd, there's a civil rights investigation into that. He definitely believes there are instances of racism, but look, he believes our law enforcement are the best in the world. He believes that by and large, they are good people. The 750 who were injured defending this country from rioters and Antifa in the streets, as to be distinguished from the peaceful protesters, those 750 officers who were hurt defending our country were heroes, as was David Dorn, a police officer who lost his life, and Patrick Underwood, who also lost his life in the last week or so.
But he doesn't think that there is systemic racism at law.
He believes most of our police officers are good, hardworking people, and there's a lot of evidence of that, and he has great faith in our police department.
Okay, well, my second question, does he still believe that NFL players who kneel as a form of protest against police brutality should be fired?
The president is very much against kneeling in general. The president has made clear for years that kneeling is tied to our national anthem, that it does not respect our military men and women across this country. He's not a fan of the kneeling movement. He's made that very clear, particularly because he thinks it's disrespectful to our military, as the kneeling originated at the kneeling during the national anthem.
Do you think they should be fired?
I have no comments on that. He is against the kneeling movement, though, as he's noted on Twitter as recently as a few days ago.
You can't say yes, he does still think they should be fired.
I have no information on that, and I have not talked to him about that.
That from the White House daily briefing earlier today. We'll have more on these stories just ahead. But first, it's reopening day in the Big Apple, and New York Governor Andrew Cuomo urging people excited about the reopening of New York City to remain, in his words, smart and vigilant in their social distancing practices in order to guard against the potential spike in the number of coronavirus cases. This morning, a masked Governor Cuomo riding the subway to work. He took the number 7 train from Queens to his office in Midtown Manhattan. The rate of the new coronavirus infections in New York City has dropped to its lowest level since the pandemic began. This from New York Mayor Bill de Blasio saying the city is now reopening for business.
Well, it is a very beautiful day today. It's a beautiful day out, but it's also a beautiful day for this city. This is a powerful day. Day 100 of the coronavirus crisis, and it is the day that we start to liberate ourselves from this disease, the day we move forward. Phase one of the restart begins today in New York City. And everyone, all New Yorkers, should be proud that you got us to this day. This was a lot of hard work. Everyone who stayed home, everyone who socially distanced, everyone who put on those face coverings, you got us to this day. And it's a day to celebrate. Hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers coming back to work today, just the beginning of the restart. But it is literally because of every single New Yorker who worked so hard to get us here. We have been the epicenter of this crisis. This is the place where it was going to be the hardest to make a comeback, and yet New York City is so strong and resilient, we are making that comeback. And we're going to always remember the heroes of this crisis, first responders, the healthcare heroes, everyone who chipped in, but also the everyday people who made this possible. So, most important thing to remember today is don't forget the lessons we've learned. We got this far by the hard work and the discipline. We got to stick to it so we can get to the next phase and the next phase and the next phase. So we're all got to keep doing that social distancing, washing the hands, the hand sanitizer, all that, the face coverings, all the things that matter. Stick with it.
That from New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. And Stephen Dinan of the Washington Times has a look at other states reopening early and the impact it's had, most notably in Georgia 6 weeks later. He's joining us on the phone here in Washington. What have you learned?
Well, so Georgia, when it reopened, and remember, the governor there defied President Trump, who said, no, I wouldn't go that far that fast. The governor there reopened everything, including salons and gyms, with social distancing. And there was a lot of prediction that it'd be a coronavirus disaster. 6 weeks later, the number of cases of coronavirus has held about static. There are several reasons for that, including the fact that we're testing a whole lot more people overall and in Georgia. But most importantly, the number of hospitalizations has tumbled. And that, you know, hospitalizations being serious coronavirus cases, that's our way of measuring it. So you saw that experience in Georgia. Something fairly similar happened in Florida as well, which was also an early opener. The third state, Texas, they were sort of a triumvirate of the early opening big states, all of them not coincidentally run by Republicans. Texas has actually seen an uptick in both cases and in hospitalizations. And it's not exactly clear what the differences are there. But at least from Georgia's standpoint, they're considering this very much a success story.
What did they do? Are there lessons for other states, most notably New York and New York City in particular, which is now beginning the process of gradually reopening?
So it's a good question. And New York, the city in particular, is such a different density and different than anywhere else in the country. I'm not sure that there are any other places that have lessons for New York City and vice versa, that New York City necessarily has lessons for anywhere else in the country. Obviously, Georgia did pursue social distancing guidelines and whatnot as they reopened, and that everywhere that has reopened has done that. I think more than anything, what the folks we talked with said was they basically brought us back to the original point of the stay-at-home orders was to, and your listeners will remember the whole bend the curve that we heard about. The point of the stay-at-home orders was to prevent the healthcare system from getting overwhelmed by a flood of cases at the beginning, and so that they would have the ability to do the right amount of medical care for those cases that needed it. And that's the folks we talked with said that's where we are. Basically, Georgia got through, and most of the states have gotten through that point where they aren't having a surge of hospitalizations, and they're ready to handle a slow increase, even if one does occur right now. There are other states there are, I think, still seven states that haven't lifted their stay-at-home orders, and they're taking maybe a different approach. They're trying to actually stamp out the disease through their stay-at-home orders rather than just slowing the curve. And Georgia's made the decision, and a number of states made the decision that, well, some more economic activity is appropriate given the risks. And then there are the seven states that have yet to make that decision.
We're talking with Stephen Dynan of the Washington Times in your accompanying story today, and an issue that we have been focusing on a lot the last couple of months, the federal government adding nearly $2 trillion to the deficit this year alone, making it by far one of the worst years on record. At some point, we will get beyond this pandemic. Do you sense any political appetite for Congress to deal with this?
I just keep looking at these numbers, and every time you see a new report on how quickly the money is going out right now, it's staggering. You put your finger on exactly the right question. I would say that we've seen some talk, including bipartisan talk, that something has to change, that when we get to the end of this massive infusion of cash to deal with coronavirus, what our fiscal situation will be like at that point is so bad that something will have to happen. But just the fact that there are some folks in both political parties here in Washington who agree that something has to happen means absolutely nothing for what those solutions actually are. And, you know, studying the last 20 years, I guess I've covered the spending and deficits for two decades now, and the attempts to rein in the deficit and to get a handle on the surging debt, they've all failed. You know, the deficit super committee failed. The Bowles-Simpson commission couldn't get an official recommendation out of its panel. We saw then Speaker John Boehner and President Obama try and strike a deal, and they did get a deal actually done in 2011. The only time in 50 years that we saw actual overall government spending drop 2 years in a row was, I believe, 2012 and 2013. But that was nibbling around the edges. I would say that we've seen some indications that folks in both parties recognize how bad the situation is. We have yet to see any indication that anybody's willing to give up their stuck in stone principles in order to solve that issue they're identifying.
And it really is a double whammy with record unemployment, not only record deficit spending, but also tax revenues on the decline. The federal government is not getting what they expected this year.
That's exactly right. Now, CBO, Congressional Budget Office, says that some of that money will come in later this year. Remember, a number of the IRS took steps to defer tax payments and tax deadlines. So some of that money will still come in later this year. But the CBO says that overall, they expect the government's not going to get all that money it expected. So you're exactly right. We're getting bit from both sides. There's trillions of dollars of cash that will go out from the coronavirus efforts this year and next year, and at the same time, the government is taking in less. Look, the most stunning thing, and it wasn't in today's report, but it was in a previous CBO report, that they said that the debt that will be incurred, basically where the country will be, or the government will be, debt-wise at the end of coronavirus, it's something like 20% of GDP worse than they were predicting at the beginning of coronavirus. That turnaround is stunning. We've advanced the time frame at which the federal debt will be 100% of gross domestic product, basically a measure of the economy. We've advanced that by a number of years. It'll basically happen a decade earlier than we thought it would earlier. Those are all really shocking numbers, and you can understand understand why there's finally some movement on Capitol Hill to say, hey, this problem, you know, it's been hanging out there forever. We've all sort of known about it. We talked about it. It's now about to confront us even earlier than we thought. So you can see why there's talk of recognizing the problem. I'm just amazed that we still aren't talking about solutions that can both sides giving something to get to solutions.
We will follow your reporting at WashingtonTimes.com. Stephen Dynan, once again, we thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
On Wall Street, by a gain of nearly 39 points, the S&P erasing its losses for the year as the markets rallied again today. The Dow rose 461, the Nasdaq up 110 points. At NYTimes.com, this headline, D.C.'s mayor fighting for control of her city at Trump's front door. Quote, after federal law enforcement agents and military troops lined up for days against protesters outside the White House, Mayor Muriel Bowser responded emphatically last Friday. She had city workers paint Black Lives Matter in giant yellow letters down a street that she has maintained command of at the center of the confrontations. The strong poke to President Trump within sight of his home, underscoring a larger power struggle between the two leaders over which one, the Democratic head of the District of Columbia or the president headquartered there, should decide who controls the streets. The full story at NYTimes.com. Yesterday on Twitter, the president thanking D.C. police and announcing the National Guard would be departing our nation's capital. Today, the mayor had this reaction.
Are you satisfied with the withdrawal of the Maryland and New Jersey National Guard forces? And are there any other forces that need to go? And along those lines, have you established a new sort of standard operating procedure with the National Guard so they make sure to inform you before their forces show up on your streets?
We understand that all of the out-of-state guard will be leaving the city. If they're not already gone, would have been gone within 48 hours, yesterday. I had another meeting with General Walker over the weekend, I believe that was, where we discussed a number of issues about the D.C. Guard. Keep in mind that the D.C. Guard is a federal guard. We have called up members of the D.C. Guard to help us with both COVID response and with demonstration response over, including both, over the last couple of months. And so we will continue to have those discussions with General Walker. Our Congresswoman has a bill before Congress that would change the organizational structure of the D.C. National Guard, which we support.
And that from the Washington, D.C. mayor. And, of course, all of these demonstrations in response to the death of George Floyd. In New York, Governor Cuomo defending his plan to release disciplinary files of police officers, saying cops should be treated the same as other government workers across New York State whose records are open to public inspection. More from New York City with Governor Andrew Cuomo.
And we're going to act in the state of New York. Transparency of disciplinary records for police officers with a call of repeal of 50A, which, by the way, what 50A says is the records of police officers will no longer be exempt from disclosure. So the records of police officers will be like every other public employee, right? They'll be like teachers, they'll be like CSEA employees or DC 37 employees in New York City. Their records will be available. And if people made complaints about them, they will be in the record and they will be released. Ban chokeholds. We went through it with Eric Garner. I mean, how many times? But pass a law that says that. The Attorney General, Special Prosecutor, 5 years ago, I did an executive order that said the Attorney General should investigate cases where police kill an unarmed person. Why? Because a local district attorney, and I have tremendous respect for the district attorneys. I was an assistant district attorney in Manhattan. But a district attorney works with that police force day in and day out. How do you expect the public to think that the local district attorney, as an arbiter, is going to be unbiased?
Governor Cuomo earlier today briefing reporters in New York City and here in Washington at the start of today's Senate session. This opening prayer from Chaplain Barry Black.
Let us pray. Eternal God, amid these challenging times, use our lawmakers to do the work of freedom. May they strive to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States to the best of their abilities. Inspire our senators to find creative ways to mitigate the effects of the painful blows that have hit this land we love. As our legislators strive to become instruments for your glory, sustain them with your grace. Lord, give them wisdom to seek to understand and help one another to seize the opportunities that accompany nearly every crisis. Provide them with clear minds, clean hands, and courageous hearts in this grand and difficult time. We pray in your powerful name. Amen.
And that from the Senate chaplain. We carry the Senate live on C-SPAN 2. Republican leader Mitch McConnell criticizing those who want to defund the police. He called the movement, in his words, outlandish. Here's what he said.
This weekend saw millions of Americans once again take to the streets and town squares to protest the deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and other black Americans at the hands of law enforcement. But unlike what our nation faced about a week ago, this weekend's demonstrations seem to have been almost entirely peaceful. No more rampant looting, no more police precincts set on fire. By and large, just peaceful protests in our great American tradition. In my home state of Kentucky and Louisville, just like around the nations, hundreds gathered to remember Breonna Taylor on what would have been her 27th birthday and to continue to call for answers. In Lexington, a moment of silence was held at an historic former slave market. Then a group marched to police headquarters. Police officers, including the chief, came out and met them in civil discourse. And while a lot of ink has been spilled recently about our big cities, we cannot miss that this moment is echoing throughout small-town America as well. It was the same story in Benton, in Danville, in Moorhead, all around the Commonwealth and all around the country. Our country has remembered that peace and protest can and must coexist.
Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, and the Senate GOP leader, also in the Congress, House Speaker Pelosi, and the Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer, sending a letter to the president asking him to reopen portions of Lafayette Square to the public. And this afternoon, Senator Schumer outlining some of his recommendations for police reform in the wake of George Floyd's death.
This morning, I joined with Speaker Pelosi and several of our House colleagues, Representatives Bass, Clyburn, Nadler, and Jeffries, as well as my colleagues, Senator Booker and Harris, to introduce the Justice in Policing Act, a response to the recent protests and the years of failure to reform our police departments. The Justice in Policing Act proposes crucial reforms to combat racial bias and excessive force by law enforcement. It would ban the use of chokeholds and other tactics that have left black Americans dead. It would limit the transfer of military weaponry and equipment to police departments. It would change the legal standard to make it easier to hold police accountable for misconduct when they use deadly force on American citizens. And through increased data and transparency, as well as important modifications to training and practices, it would help prevent police misconduct in the first place. This has never been done before at the federal level. And it would encourage the same changes at the state and local level in order for those police departments to receive federal funds. In the Senate, Democrats are going to fight like hell to make this proposal a reality. Americans who took to the streets have demanded change. With this legislation, Democrats are heeding their call. Now is the time for Leader McConnell to commit to putting police reform on the floor of the Senate before July 4th to be debated and voted on. Several Republicans have acknowledged egregious wrong, but too few have expressed a need for floor action. Too many remain silent. Maybe our Republican friends are hoping the issue goes away. I promise them it will not.
The Senate Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer of New York. And yesterday, the New York Times announcing that James Bennett has resigned his position as the head of their editorial page, a resignation that took effect immediately. Bennett, by the way, is the brother of 2020 White House candidate and Colorado Senator Michael Bennett. He had apologized late last week after previously defending the piece, which was titled Send in the Troops. Senator Cotton of Arkansas calling for the government to deploy troops as a last resort to help stop the riots and looting that emerged amid the anger over George Floyd's death in Minneapolis. The publication sparking a revolt among New York Times journalists, with some saying it endangered black employees, a number of staff members calling in sick late last week. The resignation of James Bennett bringing this reaction from the author of that op-ed, Senator Cotton. He was on Fox News earlier today.
I know, Brian. It's amazing. You know, it all started on this program just a week ago after the violence and looting that we saw in Washington, D.C., where a famous church was torched and our memorials were desecrated and businesses were looted. I said on your program last Monday that the National Guard needs to be called in, and if they can't back up police sufficiently enough to stop this anarchy on our streets, then the Insurrection Act provides the president with the final resort tool that he needs. Now, fortunately, more and more cities and states called in the National Guard through Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of last week, and that was not necessary. But the New York Times actually asked me to explain in further detail that exact point I made. They even defended it. The publisher defended the decision to publish that column after it was published, and the mob in their newsroom began to demand that it be taken down, there be consequences. And within a day, it turned into something like a struggle session from the Cultural Revolution in Mao's China, where the adults had to prostrate themselves and apologize in front of the woke children that apparently now run the New York Times newsroom. And now you've had the opinion page editor have to resign. But let's be clear, this all goes back to the publisher and his unwillingness to stand up to a bunch of 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds who were raised on social justice seminars on our campuses. They need to behave like grown-ups, not like children who are confronted with an opinion that they don't like.
That's from Senator Cotton on Fox News earlier today. But the House Democratic Whip James Clyburn of South Carolina, who, by the way, is the highest-ranking African-American in Congress, had this reaction to that New York Times op-ed written by Senator Cotton of Arkansas.
Because it has always been able to repair its faults. That's what makes this country great. And most right-thinking Americans know that the greatness of this country is at stake. We have unveiled, for whatever reason, some faults that need to be repaired. Faults in our healthcare system, faults in our judicial system. So let me say to Mr. Cotton, pick up in the history book of America. I would ask him to please just read the history of Isaac Woodard, a black man who came home from World War II on the bus from Fort Gordon, Georgia, trying to get to South Carolina. And he was stopped, taken off a bus in Batesburg, South Carolina, by a deputy sheriff. He was in his uniform. And that deputy sheriff took his billy stick and punched his eyes out. Is that institutional in law enforcement? And that has been the foundation upon which law enforcement in many parts of this country have been established. Cotton is from Arkansas. He ought to be ashamed of himself.
That from Congressman Jim Clyburn, Democrat of South Carolina. In other news, a spokesperson for George W. Bush saying that the New York Times report that the former president will not support President Trump's reelection was, quote, completely made up. Freddie Ford telling the Texas Tribune that the Sunday story, which cited people familiar with Bush's thinking, was false, but that Bush will avoid speaking publicly on his 2020 presidential vote, saying he is retired from politics and has not indicated how he will vote. But former Secretary of State Colin Powell, who served under President Bush, announcing on CNN's State of the Union yesterday that he, in fact, will be backing former Vice President Joe Biden. Well, President Trump's overall job approval rating dropping 7 percentage points over the last month, according to a survey released today by CNN, also showing him trailing former Vice President Joe Biden by 14 points ahead of the general election in November. That same CNN poll showing that 38% of the respondents said that they approve of the way the president is handling his job, 57% disapprove. And in battleground state Florida, Real Clear Politics has Joe Biden up by 8 points in the average of recent polling in that state. One snapshot in time with a long way to go before the November election. The Biden campaign is, though, beginning to ratchet up its spending in advertising. One of those spots now on the air in Florida.
Some mornings that I wake up, I wonder whether or not we're living in 2020 or 1920. I hear the echoes of the not-so-distant past and the fight that we have fought before. In 1963, Americans witnessed the cruelty of Bull Connor and his dogs and the fire hoses assaulting hundreds of students, some as young as first grade. These images shocked the nation. Today, it's not fire hoses and snarling dogs. It's Donald Trump's poisonous and divisive politics. We've seen the rise in attacks on Jews, the attack on immigrants. His rhetoric has embodied the worst among us. If I've learned anything during the time of Donald Trump being president is this, hate never goes away, it just hides. I know moments like this can be disheartening. It seems like we're on the verge of so much progress just a few short years ago. That's why we have to restore the soul of the nation. But I haven't given up hope. If Bull Connor had hoped to put a stake in the heart of the civil rights movement, he achieved the exact opposite. Sometimes those who fan the flames of hate end up drawing forth the next wave of progress. We now have a tremendous opportunity because America's been awakened as how bad things are. To take the next step forward, we have a great, great opportunity to give the marginalized, the demonized, the isolated, the oppressed a full share of the American dream. It gives us an opportunity to root out systemic racism. In the words of James Cleveland, we've come too far from where we started. Nobody told me this road would be easy. I don't believe he brought us this far to leave me. And he will not leave me because of you. So thank you all. May God bless you and may God protect our troops. We have a lot of work to do. Please continue to give hope, hope, hope. Thank you.
Campaign 2020 here on C-SPAN, and as the country and the world reflects on the D-Day invasion, which occurred 76 years ago this month, this ad from the Lincoln Project, a GOP group, opposed to the president's re-election.
In the early hour D-Day, General Dwight D. Eisenhower prepared an announcement that, thankfully, he never had to make.
Our landings in the Normandy area have failed to gain a foothold. And I have withdrawn the troops.
Great leaders prepare for every eventuality. They hope for the best, but they prepare for the worst.
The troops did all that bravery and devotion to duty could do. And if any blame or fault attaches to the attempt, it is mine alone.
Today, America faces new crises with new leaders.
Did disband the White House pandemic office.
Yeah, I didn't do it. We have a group of people. Yeah, no, I don't take responsibility at all because we were...
Isn't it time America returned to a different kind of leadership?
The Lincoln Project is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Well, that's from a group of Republicans opposed to the president, and yet with Friday's encouraging jobs report, a new ad, a new tactic by the Trump-Pence campaign calling for what they say will be the great American comeback. Here is that ad.
The Great American Comeback has begun. A record 2.5 million new jobs in May. And we're just getting started. Before the pandemic, President Trump made our economy the envy of the world. Now he's doing it again, bringing devastated industries back, working to build factories here instead of China, getting direct cash relief to families, renewing, restoring, rebuilding. Together, we'll make America great again.
I'm Donald J. Trump, and I approve this message.
And a reminder, you can follow the campaign, including word from the Trump campaign that there will be more Make America Great Again rallies scheduled for later this summer. And, of course, the party convention scheduled for August in Milwaukee for the Democrats and TBD for the Republicans. This program, Washington Today, is available as a podcast. You can find it on our website at cspan.org/podcast. I'm Steve Scully in our nation's capital. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. Enjoy the rest of your evening.